And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
Over 15 years ago, I started working on a project that included three sets of numbers. And these three sets of numbers were probably the most powerful educational material that I had to help people make some huge decisions. Decisions about what equity asset classes should be in their portfolio. And that was supported by a table entitled The Ultimate Buy and Hold Strategy. And then after that, there was a fine-tuning table that showed the impact of creating a worldwide portfolio, a balance in the equity part of the portfolio, a balance of big and small and value and growth, U.S. international, with slices of emerging markets and REITs. And that was an interesting table because that table allowed us to compare the risk and return of portfolios built with no equities, 10% equities, 20% equities, 30, 40, 50, 60, all the way to 100% equities. Of course, the part that wasn't equities was in bonds. And that was called the fine-tuning table. And it went along because it was using the same equity asset classes that were in the ultimate buy and hold strategy article and table. And then the next step in the process was to apply those returns starting in 1970, apply those returns of the different combinations of stocks and bonds to a portfolio that started with $1 million and showed what happened if you took out 4% or 5% or 6%. What would happen to the value of the portfolio in terms of sustaining whatever cost of living that you had created? What were the odds of running out of money before you run out of life? It was all in those distribution tables. Now, there are so many ways you can slice and dice tables about distributions or about asset allocation, but this was simply a combination of presentations that tried to give a perspective. As we all know, the past is not prologue. Just because the S&P 500 over the last 47 years has compounded at 10.3%, doesn't mean that that's what it's going to look like the next 47 years. And the same with the fixed income. That portfolio from 1970 through 2016 compounded at 6.1. So what does that mean in terms of the next 47 years? Who knows? Where can you get 6.1% now in an intermediate term treasury bond? Well, you can't. So when we look backwards, we're not looking for facts about the future. We're talking about getting perspective, getting a hold of the potential, a range of returns, a range of risk. And recently into my life, after I've been working with value for many, many years as a part of the portfolio, I decided to break out the value as a standalone part of the portfolio and created what is the fine-tuning table, just like the worldwide equity portfolio table, the fine-tuning table for an all-value portfolio. Now, I have a link where this podcast is housed here. I have a link that shows you where you can download a copy of the worldwide equity portfolio fine-tuning table, as well as the all value, and also one for the S&P 500, along with these different combinations of fixed income, so that you can compare in 100 different ways, if you wish, you can compare what would the risk have been, what would the return have been, this is in the past, over the last 47 years. And which one would you feel more comfortable with for the next 47 years? And I want to warn those that are simply going to look at returns and have that be the basis of your decision that you might want to go beyond that and consider the real risk of a portfolio that is overweighted in a particular kind of security. Certainly, as you're going to find out, for a young first-time investor, an all-value portfolio may make perfect sense. On the other hand, we might think, as I'm 73, while I do have a percentage of my portfolio in this all-value strategy or portfolio that I'm going to talk about here, that is a very small part of the total portfolio. But value as a component part of the worldwide strategy that I have is a very large part. So my job here is to try to get you to understand as best I see it what the risk is, what the potential return is, and then to give you some clarity about where that might fit in your portfolio. Remembering, I am not your investment advisor. I am your teacher. And so to the extent that you need to dig deeper and you need more help in identifying where you fit in all of this, I think you need to find an advisor who understands what I'm talking about, and most will, and understand your personal situation. So let's talk about these three tables and find out how we might compare them to give us a sense of where these different strategies might be viewed as a part of our portfolio. Let's start with the traditional worldwide equity portfolio. That's the fine-tuning table I've been producing for over 15 years. And here's what I can see. Let me just kind of get in here and focus on a couple of these columns in that table. First of all, I want to make sure you understand this table. On the left, it says 100% bonds up at the top of the first column. And so that's an intermediate term bond. So it's low risk, it's treasury-based, U.S. treasuries. So not only is there going to be, because it's an intermediate, a minimal amount of volatility as interest rates rise and fall, but also it gives us a guarantee. And that guarantee is important because when the stock market really falls apart, there tends to be a rush into government-guaranteed securities. The last example of that was 2008, when corporate bonds collapsed along with high yield. I mean, the high grade and the high yield both went down substantially, but the U.S. treasuries went up substantially, which is what you want from bonds that are there to not only stabilize, but maybe give you a little kick in the return during a serious stock market decline. Now, I'm going to focus on a couple of these columns. The first column will be the 100% stock column, because that really represents what that equity portfolio would have done without any defense at all, other than just the diversification of thousands and thousands of individual companies. And so from 1970 through 2016, the annualized return, or the compound rate of return, for the 100% stock, again, that's a 50-50 U.S. international, some big, some small, some value, some growth, etc., that had a compound rate of return of 11.4%. Now, you can compare that to the S&P 500, which made over that period of time 10.3%. So that's over a 1% difference. And I've talked endlessly about how life-changing 0.5% can make, well, obviously, it even gets better when it's 1% or more. But anytime we look at the return of something, we want to see what the risk is. And there are a couple of ways to measure risk. Well, in fact, there are a whole bunch of them. But the most common one amongst statisticians would be the standard deviation, which is simply a measure of volatility. The important thing to remember is that when you compare the standard deviation of two investments, the one with the lower number is the one that represents something that is less volatile. Now, the fact is, in this particular case, while the standard deviation for the 100% stock worldwide equity portfolio was 14.7%, and the S&P 500, the column right to the right of it, was 15.2%, that does suggest that the volatility over that period of time with the more diversified global diversification was actually a little less risky. But for all practical purposes, you could probably say that the standard deviation was basically the same. But when you look at the real loss of money during that whole period, what you'll notice is the worst 12 months for the 100% stock portfolio was down 51.2%, whereas the S&P 500 was down 43.3%. You can feel the extra pain that you would have been aware of had your portfolio been down 51% in a year instead of the 43%. That's a big difference, but remember, you never take a risk unless there is an expectation of a premium, and that premium is the difference between the 10.3 and the 11.4. Now, sometimes the premium is absolutely huge. Like in 1977, the S&P 500 was down 7.2%, while the worldwide stock portfolio was up 26.8%. So that's a huge difference in favor of the worldwide strategy, but to be fair, I could find a year like 1997 where the S&P 500 was up 33.4 and the worldwide equity was up 4.4. So a huge advantage to the S&P. But at the end of the day, what I'm interested in is the long-term, the slog, the just beating it out in up and down markets. What's the end result? Well, again, that end result is a little over 1% advantage at about the same risk standard deviation, but a little worse loss with the worldwide equity. Now, I'm going to give you a spoiler alert here. The reason that the worldwide portfolio was down 51 versus the 43 for the S&P 500 was mostly because of the value part of the portfolio. And you'll see that in just a second. And we can also look at the worst drawdown at the very bottom of the page. You can talk about a year having the worst year, and you can, you know what period of time that is. It's 12 months. But you can have a drawdown, a decline, that has nothing to do with a particular period of time. It's just whatever the worst decline was before the market turned around and went back to be worth more than the decline started at. And what you'll see is, again, the decline, the drawdown was worse with the 100% stock, the worldwide strategy, rather than the S&P 500. And you can do that on this whole page. I like to look at 60-40, and the reason I like 60-40 is because the volatility of 60-40, you'll notice the standard deviation of the 60-40 column is 9.1. So that's over a one-third less risk And most of the return, the compound rate of return, was 9.6. Now, I'm going to make a point here that's very important in terms of whether you're a do-it-yourselfer or you're using somebody to manage this for you. That 9.6 is after extracting a 1% management fee that is above and beyond the costs that were figured for running the mutual funds that would have given you the exposure to these asset classes. So in theory, if you didn't pay that 1%, you actually would have done better than the S&P 500, or about the same, but at much, much less risk. And the other thing that I really like about that lower risk, I mean, when we talk standard deviation, it just doesn't hit us in the gut like losing money does. And when I look at the money that was lost in the 60-40 strategy, it is much, much less than what was lost in the all equity portfolios. So you can look at a year like 1974, where the S&P was down 26.5 and the worldwide equity was down 22.6, but the 60-40 was down 11.7. So that's the beauty of having fixed income in your portfolio, is that it minimizes, stabilizes the losses that you get from equities. On the other hand, you don't make as much money, but for a lot of people, they'd be very happy if they got 9 or 10%, but could do it with much, much lower risk than owning an all-equity portfolio. So this is the table that I've been showing people for many years and trying to give perspective to risk and return. But now that I am starting to show the value-only portfolio, what we have to do is to look at those same relationships from all bonds this fine-tuning table says ultimate buy and hold all value equity portfolio. So we have U.S. and international and emerging markets, everything value all the time. Now, having said that, let me just tell you that if you went to Morningstar and you put the recommendations that any mutual fund advisor would give you, and they would say, here's a good value fund, when you do the Morningstar style box that shows how much is in large and small and mid-cap and value and growth parts of this 9-box style box configuration, what you're going to find is even in the best of small cap value funds or ETFs, you're going to see there's some very likely a little bit of mid cap in there, maybe a little bit of bland, even sometimes a little bit of growth. So when you try to go out and buy this asset class, the value asset class, don't think you're going to get perfection. You're not, at least not that I can find. And I am looking on your behalf. So when I look at this fine-tuning table, the all value, I quickly look at the column that says 100% stock. And we're still basically 50-50 U.S. international, except again, we've thrown out most of the growth part of the portfolio. And while you may not see this as a huge difference, you'll see the compound rate of return goes up to 12.1. Now, before, with the worldwide, it was 11.4. So we haven't added another 1%, but we have added 0.7%. And that's still a meaningful difference, depending, of course, on how much more risk that we take. And when you start looking at the distribution tables, I think it will start to illuminate how important this difference of an extra 0.7% can be in terms of what you have to spend and what you have to leave to others at your passing. So then the question comes, because now we see, okay, we got the premium for taking risk. Was it enough premium? Well, to know that, you got to know how much more risk. So let's go down the column under the 100% stocks. Let's go down to the worst 12 months. And the worst 12 months was a loss of 52.7 compared to 43 for the S&P. And if you remember, about 51 for the worldwide. So, you know something? Whether I'm down 51% or 53%, at that point, I don't think it's going to make much difference. Of course, I'm assuming it's going to come back, and that's what investors will invariably say. They'll say, oh, I don't care how much I lose as long as I know it'll come back. Well, the only problem in that statement is we can never know it's going to come back. We can hope, we can plan on it, but we can't know. And when we look at the very worst drawdown with the all value, it's a loss of 60% versus a loss of 58.6 with the worldwide strategy. And by the way, when I look over at the S&P 500, I see that it was down. It was down the 50.9. Now you'll see that it's actually down a little bit more. Let me explain that. How can you have one column that says 100% S&P 500 that is slightly different than the one that says the S&P 500 index? And the difference is there because the index has no expenses, but we applied an expense of 0.1% a year to the S&P 500 because you can't get it for free. Now, you can get it for 0.05% per year, but we used 0.1% for the study. So let's then look at the 60-40 and compare. Now, the 60-40 with the all value compounded at 10. Now, as you may or may not recall, with the worldwide portfolio, it was 9.6. And over here with the S&P 500, it was 9.3. So 9.3 for the S&P, 9.6 for the worldwide equity, and 10 for the all-value portfolio. Slight increases, but slight increases, if maintained over the rest of your life, are certainly worth fighting for if they don't put you over the edge in terms of a sense of risk. So the bottom line is this. We can either look at our portfolio all as one and try to determine the risk we're willing to take, or we can look at the pieces. Now, I personally, I'm forced in a way to look at the pieces because, to begin with, half of my portfolio uses market timing. And I don't advocate that for any more than maybe one out of 100 people. Maybe it's one out of every 200 people. It's a small number. There are all sorts of challenges with timing that just turns most investors inside out. I've lived with it since 1983, and I find it very comforting to have a portion of the portfolio being defensively managed, but that's my bias. For you, I would guess your bias will be to be more of a buy and holder. You don't have to think. You don't have to do much. But the bottom line is that when I look at my portfolio, I look at the risk and return of the combinations of buy and hold, and then I look at the combinations for timing. And for me, for example, in buy and hold, I'm a 50-50 guy. Why? Because I'm going to lose money. According to any of these tables, I'm going to lose money, and it looks like I got to be willing to lose somewhere between 25 and 30%. And at my age and just the sleep factor, I don't want to lose any more than 30%. And with the timing portion of the portfolio, that number is a lot lower. But for the buy and hold, that's my limit. And so when I look at this, I notice that I could be a 50-50 strategy, whether I'm an all-value buy and hold or a worldwide buy and hold. The worst 12 months for 50-50 is almost exactly the same. Now, what I've actually done is I have taken a part of my portfolio, but I said earlier, it's a very small part of my portfolio, and applied it to an all-value strategy. And it happens to be the part of my portfolio that is a Roth, that I am not going to touch for the rest of my life, so I am willing to be more aggressive with that money. On the other hand, the rest of my portfolio in the equity portion is about half value. So I really do have a very large commitment to what you could call an all-value portfolio. But I also have some growth as well. And the reason is this. We always have to think, and at least this is my philosophy, hope for the best, prepare for the worst. And what is the worst? What does that look like? Well, I suspect that if each one of us describe the worst, maybe we would describe a medical state that we might be in. But when I'm talking about investing, what I see as the worst is the kind of a meltdown that we had back in 29 to 32. And for what it's worth, the meltdown in 73 and 74 was very similar, particularly when you inflation adjust, as the meltdown of 29 to 32. And here's what happens. When you get into a very, very difficult market, what happens is value stocks can take a beating, a worse beating than growth stocks. Now, in a normal kind of bear market, that might not be the case. In fact, historically, and this is kind of, it's easy to understand if you think about it. What is a value stock? Well, a value stock is a stock that's out of favor for some reason. It's typically down in price, sometimes significantly down in price. And it's actually gone through its own private bear market, maybe while growth stocks are doing just fine. Now, the reasons for it being out of favor could be anything from just bricks and mortar companies are not in favor, as we had in the late 90s, where technology was king of the roost, and sometimes it's because an industry itself is very out of favor because it has problems with the government, or maybe it has problems with simply being behind in technology. There's some reason why investors are not giving it a high value, but which is interesting because a value company might be thought of as a really good one, but in fact, it typically tends to be a company or an industry that is struggling for probably very well-known reasons. But I do know that when we have a traditional, big, bad bear market, that value stocks are likely to take another hit in the gut, and it can be a bad one. Whereas growth stocks, where maybe there's better management, maybe there's better strength in finding their financial position, tend not to fall apart as badly as the value stocks might. So it may only happen a couple times in a lifetime. But as we get older, it's those couple of times that we don't want to have happen to us. And so I have chosen not to be an all-value person. But I certainly would be an advocate for an all-value portfolio for a first-time investor. Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, if you go back to that that article about how to turn $3,000 into $50 million, if you go back and read that, what you'll find that I suggest is for a newborn child to put the money in small cap value, leave it there. In fact, maybe you even leave it there for the rest of that person's career. Again, going back to that article, what I recommended was you put away either $3,000 once or $365 a year for 21 years. Either strategy theoretically works. And then as soon as the child starts making money, that you can take the money out of this pool that you've created and put it into their Roth IRA. And you do that until your investment that you made is gone and is now all in the child or the grandchild's Roth IRA. And then leave it alone. Now, maybe you leave it alone in a small cap value, or you leave it alone in an all value portfolio. But in that situation, for what in theory is a small part of the total savings that person will ever make, maybe it could be all value for the rest of their life. Now, that's going to depend on knowing more about that investor later. But yes, there are cases where an all value portfolio makes sense. And I must say, it always seems to shock me. I always am taken back when I run into somebody who's 65 or 70 years old and they are still 100% in stocks. And I'm thinking, wow. And by the way, those are usually individual stocks. I think that's a risk you don't have to take anymore. But it's what they grew up with. It's what they learned to love, and they still love it. Well, maybe if somebody grew up with an all-value portfolio, they'd learn to love that too and trust it. Because hopefully with love comes trust. Anyway, these three tables, I think, are filled with so many lessons. Let me give you another one. This is a small one, but I love this. I spotted this. My wife and I were on vacation in New Zealand, and it was our first trip to New Zealand. And I got to say, it's the most beautiful country I've ever been in. The people are great. The food is good. It's expensive. Although I'm sure one could do it for less money than we spent. But generally, it's not cheap, I don't think, to live there. But Daryl Balls, the person who does all this work to create these tables from the database that we have from Dimensional Funds, he sent them to me just before I was about, to get on the plane to fly back from New Zealand to the U.S., and I could not have been a happier guy than to have these tables in my hands. And by the way, there were a ton of additional tables on distributions and things that I'll be sharing with you later. But I literally, in the entire trip back, other than the time that I was sleeping, I did not watch any movies. I did not watch any TV. I did not read the book I set aside to read while I was coming back. I spent the entire waking time, other than talking with my wife, looking at all these tables and asking, what lessons are there in these tables that could actually be of importance to an investor? Remembering that I'm looking for every advantage you can find. And let me share one that was really kind of a surprise to me. But I guess in hindsight, it makes sense. One of the things I noted many years ago, when I started looking, and I'm going to look here at the fine-tuning table for the worldwide equity portfolio, I noticed that when you invested in 100% bonds, the compound rate of return was 6.1%. When you added 10% equity, the risk was virtually the same in terms of the standard deviation. The worst 6 months or 12 months was a little more, but for all practical purposes, we're talking about the worst 12 months you had to live through. And if you had time on your side and you were willing, you wanted to be all fixed income, I might just do a little arm twisting and say, hey, look at adding 10% equity, just a little bit. Look what it does to your return. You go from 6.1 to 6.7. And if you added another 10%, so your 20% equities, instead of 6.1, now you're up to 7.3%. Now, I thought that was pretty interesting. What I found is, by the way, an important difference. When I looked at the all value portfolio, I noticed that you go from 6.1 in the first column to 6.8 in the second, and from 6.8 to 7.5. So what you did basically is you added 0.2% to that return. And that's, as you'll see later in the distributions, that turns out to be an important difference. And so if you were just going to put 20% in your portfolio, you didn't want much equities, I might be suggesting, actually, since you're going to have so little in equities, I might suggest that you use the value portfolio rather than the worldwide portfolio. Now, by the way, the value portfolio is half international, just as is the worldwide half international. All that's happening is we're basically throwing out the more growth part of the portfolio. So I hope that is of some help in understanding why I have spent so much time on explaining the all-value portfolio. I hope that, as Rich Buck and I recommended in the article that we recently wrote, that'll be coming out in the next week or so, that it might be good to actually take a couple of fingers here and compare columns, one column, one year at a time. For example, if you compare the 100% stock portfolio, I'm looking at the all value table now, and you compared it to the S&P 500, at the end of the first year, you would not see any difference of significance. But in the second year, the all value portfolio did much better. Then it did worse. Then it did worse. Then it did better, much better. Then it did better, and then it did worse. I mean, you're going to see this difference between these two equity portfolios that will hopefully do one important thing: get you out of the trap of starting to look at your portfolio and compare to see how it did either to the S&P 500 or to CDs. Because you're not going to look like the S&P if you have an all-value portfolio. By the way, that would be true if your value were only in the United States, because the S&P 500 is basically mostly growth. So there you go. I hope that to your friends, particularly to your friends who like numbers, that you will pass this along. And I hope that you will stick around in the coming weeks as we explore the implications of the all-value portfolio as it might have on your distributions. And for those who are looking forward to the update, the annual update of the distributions for the worldwide portfolio, we will have that available in the coming weeks as well. Thank you for listening. And oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, we, as most of you, I'm sure, know, we have created all value portfolios at Motif. Motifinvesting.com. And in fact, what you should do is you should go to paulmerriman.com and access Motif through our website, because it will potentially give our foundation some income. But I've created these Motif portfolios using all value ETFs. But you could also use the value funds that I've recommended at Vanguard, at Fidelity, at Schwab, and you could build your all value portfolio using their ETFs. What we tried to do with Motif is to create what we call a best in class, so that for every asset class we're selecting for investors, that we're picking the one that is the best we can find in the whole ETF universe. So you can certainly check that out, and you don't have to buy those ETFs through Motif. You can buy them wherever you like. The thing about Motif that we like, and I've done a whole podcast on this, if you haven't heard it, I hope you'll look it up. But the thing we like about Motif is the ease with which you can rebalance a portfolio, which for a lot of people is a real hassle. And the cost once a year to rebalance the portfolio is $9.95, whether you have 5 ETFs or you have 30 ETFs, it's the same $9.95, and you eliminate all that time that you spend trying to figure out how much goes into each of those portfolios. Thank you for listening, and please, I'd love questions on this. Why don't you send them to Paul at paulmerriman.com? And I'll try my best to answer them either in our newsletter or in the Q&As that we do on podcasts, or we have a page devoted, a Q&A section of the Motif page at paulmerriman.com. So there are 3 places we potentially can help you with Q&As. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.